Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 332nd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Michael Lippert. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Andy Young on the show. He's an editor extraordinaire. He's here to talk to us about Harley Quinn, which is in its third season, available on HBO Max as we speak, hopefully for a while longer. It's a HBO politics joke.
What, Discovery Plus, Warner Brothers, something? Who knows?
Discovery Plus, all that stuff is going on. It's worth it to say that we had this conversation before the Zaslav massacre, for lack of a better term. For those not paying super close attention, after the Discovery and Warner merger, they started cutting things and taking things off the platform. Harley Quinn is still available, so don't worry about our good friend Andy.
And he has a friend.
Yes.
We've been knowing him for a long time. He's probably one of the very first podcast fans. It's been a long journey, and we talk a lot about it on this episode. He's just such a fun guy. You know, he comes from live action. He comes really from like the world of comedy. He started at Rooster Teeth in Austin, and he's so friendly and like definitely comes off as this like harmless dude. But then once we talked to him for a while, I started realizing how it was all so calculated.
A stone cold killer. This is a great conversation about ways in which you can authentically network, be your true self, not be out to get anything, but besides kind of transparently wanting to connect with people, collaborate with people, help people, and therefore help your own career as well. Andy has cut a lot of stuff for the two of us, a lot of commercials. He cut my wife's feature, See You Next Christmas. So we know him pretty darn well. If you're listening to this podcast, you could be the next Andy Young. You could be a rags to riches, film school to superstar winner if you continue to listen to the show and help us out regularly.
And I even love his story about like how he ended up on this episode, which I think is pretty good. Well, before we regale you with the adventures of Andy Young, I just want to remind people that we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place where you can come support us, just to help us out to make this podcast. But yeah, patreon.com/justshootitpod. Any money you give us, $1 a month, even $15 a month, which gets you a Just Shoot It hat, which is really fun. But it just lets us know that you're listening, that you want us to keep going, and that we should pay our editor. We appreciate it all. patreon.com/justshootitpod. Matt, do you think, I mean, we've been teasing this for like 2 years, but do you think we're going to do like a live show in 2022?
Boy, wouldn't that be nice. I have been thinking a lot about how October is coming. I get served a lot of spooky t-shirts on Instagram. They've got their demo dialed in.
Yeah.
And I like to have like a fun spooky t-shirt for the Just Shoot It horror episode, which we have done live before. And it would be really fun to do live again.
I 100% agree. Hopefully we can do it. I kind of thought we were like on the way out. I have been in the Midwest for the past week. So maybe that's why I saw maybe 5 or 6 masks my entire trip, not including the airport. We were invited to a screening of a movie tomorrow. And I asked the person that directed the movie, he said that we're doing it outside. And I said, why don't we do it inside? And he said, well, COVID. So I guess it's still a thing, even if you're only having like 4 people over for a screening.
Maybe it's outdoors.
Yeah, I guess we can do an outdoor venue.
I don't know. Let us know what you think. Angelinos in particular.
Yeah. Now, potentially a word from our sponsor, if not Andy Young.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, we are here with our favorite fan, also editor, also just a great all-around film guy, Andy Young. Welcome to the show.
Long-time listener, first-time complainer.
First-time guest. Yeah. I don't know. You might have emailed us before about something and then we might have read it.
Actually, it's funny. I went back and looked it up. I started listening to the show in like 2015 when I saw my friend Matt Pollock was on it. 2015 was kind of a weird year for me. I was still in Austin. I felt like I was supposed to go to LA, but I didn't want to. And then y'all's podcast was kind of convincing me to.
Sorry.
Or that you guys convinced me to move out here.
Yeah.
No, it was the smartest thing I ever did. I'm working with Batman now. I asked you guys anonymously if you thought that I should take this big job I got offered or move to LA. And you both had said move to LA. But I was like in kind of dire straits when they asked me. And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I really, this company's fine, but they're just not my bag. I really feel like I need to be in LA. And smartest thing I ever did. You guys convinced me to come down, kind of give it a go. And were super helpful in getting me most of my, I think a lot of people I've worked with since have come from me listening to your show. So thank you for inadvertently giving me a career.
I guess I was excited to maybe give my version of the Andy Young career.
Oh, please.
But you definitely deflated it a little bit already. So my version of Andy Young is that he was just a doe-eyed young boy living in rural Texas, mm-hmm. you know, playing around with tapes and VCRs and things.
Back in the sticks of Austin, Texas.
He happened upon an old-time radio show called Just Shoot It, learned everything there is to know about filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure you hitchhiked to L.A. Mm-hmm.
Yep, mm-hmm. Nothing but a wing and a dream.
Yeah, Andy is basically like a real-life Muppet. And this is
I watched the Muppet movie and I was like, I will live my life by the first 30 minutes of this film.
Yeah, and you emailed us and you said, hey, let's meet. I wanted to write up an article about some podcasts I like.
Which is,
I definitely use the Movie Maker thing as a guise to like, meet a lot of people, you guys for sure being one of them.
That is the way, if you really want to like have coffee with someone and hope that they like can introduce you to other people, interviewing them is the move. And like, obviously Andy is living proof of that. And so are Oren and I.
Exactly. No, 100%. You guys have, I'm sure, met so many and probably gotten a ton of jobs because you have this
some
podcast.
Jobs, and some jobs, but we've met a lot of people.
Yeah. It's definitely, it helps. And then it just like sears you to all of the right people. Like I started writing for Movie Maker in college, just interviewing all of my heroes. And a lot of them ended up getting me jobs at random points, including like through you guys meeting like, you know, the Sawhorse guys and Carlin and, you know, all these other people I've gone on to have really fruitful working relationships with. So I don't know. I always recommend that to people though. Just start like a blog, make it sound more important than it is. And just be like, make it mutually beneficial. Like, I'll interview you for this film website.
You'll get exposure. You
know? I'll speed through the rest of this story.
Please.
So we met you then. Pretty sure I introduced you to Sawhorse. Launched your career. You'd never seen a computer before until then. But then learned how to edit. And then I think after you We're an on-set editor on an amazing Bush's Beans branded video.
Yeah.
Directed by me. You know, everyone started recognizing your talents.
He moved on to the world of features as well.
You might have done some stuff with Matt. I don't know that really affected your career very much.
Yeah. The height of my career, February 2020, was really, you guys really helped me out. Yeah.
Because my daughter goes to preschool with the son of Justin Halpern, and I think even though I never mentioned Andy's name to Justin, I think just being in the same room probably, you know.
By osmosis, so we're looking for an editor. He must know one.
Yeah. Got you on a Warner Brothers DC show, Harley Quinn, and now you're famous. And, you know, I will settle for 45%, not the usual 50%.
I was going to say, this is why you guys get a cut of my paycheck every week. Yeah. What a long, strange, roundabout way to describe my career in pitch perfect detail. I don't even know if we need to go through anything else. No. What else is there to learn?
So unpaid endorsements. You got one? Okay, so that's my version of Andy Young. Matt, you have anything to add to that, or should we let Andy fill in the blanks?
Did you intern at College Humor? Is that right?
So I graduated in 2014, and I went to UT Austin, and they had this program called UTLA, where you could spend a semester in LA, and I had two internships. I interned for the Duplass brother, because I had met Jay through Movie Maker, and then I also...
You did the same shtick? You're like, hey, Jay, I'd love to write an article about you.
That's what he's saying. Yes.
Wait, how did you find his contact info?
I guessed. Because this was like in 2011. He wasn't like, you know, star of Transparency.
He wasn't famous yet, basically.
Yeah, there was some, it's probably still up. There was like this little hub of a thing. And I was like, hey, I went to film school at UT. I know you guys did too. Can I just interview you? And then over the years, like me and Jay just kept like talking and stuff. And then I did a bit of stuff for them in LA. But the big one I did was College Humor. And the first thing I ever worked on in LA was this like Coke Jake and Amir thing that Inlo directed.
I did not realize you worked on that, Andy. That's so funny.
I was an assistant editor, technically. I like organized all the footage. So I heard you being like, Amir, could you say this like this?
You talk about this all the time. You didn't know Andy worked on it?
I didn't.
This was like the height of my career.
It was my first like big branded spot, basically.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. I didn't realize that you worked on it at all.
And years later, I actually cut a TV show for Jake and Amir. And unfortunately, it didn't get picked up. But I told them, I was like, hey, the first thing I ever did in LA was I worked on this like spot that you guys did. And they were like, all right.
They're like, cool. Great.
No, they were cool.
It was really hot that day.
I've been waiting to be on here for 7 years. I feel like I've given such a non-linear version.
So it sounds to me like before Oren, quote unquote, changed Andy's career, back when Andy was in college, I changed his life. So that's an interesting little nugget. To bring it back to people who aren't in our immediate circle of friends.
This must just sound ridiculous to everyone.
In summary, Andy did a really good job of working his network, working his connections, creating excuses to talk to people who could help introduce him to other people. But also, I think to your point, it was an equitable relationship. You were giving them exposure. You know, Andy, you've cut stuff for free for me. Like a handful of times.
And that stuff has always led to like more work through like people who worked on that or people who like that thing. And people always say I'm really good at networking, but it took me a long time to kind of, it's a skill you have to hone. And I remember you guys talking a lot about it on like the early days of the podcast. But I remember when I first moved here, I knew I wasn't going to have any work for like a while. Like I was still doing like Rooster Teeth jobs or whatever to pay the bills from a distance. But I was always like 3 to 4 times a day, I would like try to get a coffee or a lunch or a dinner or a movie date, whatever, I would try to like meet someone or see someone new again and just try to like
3 to 4 times a day.
Yeah. And I was such an idiot too. I was like, okay, I'm in Burbank. How long will it take to get to Santa Monica? I'll figure it out. Like I made it kind of my day job when I first moved here because I didn't want to just like sit around waiting, but I didn't know anybody out here. So while I was doing jobs, I would basically like through the podcast or through other connections I had made, like I would meet like, I remember I had like a meeting at the Jim Henson Company through like a friend's cousin. Like that was like the whole like chain of things. They knew I was a big Muppet fan. It's like I would try to find all that.
I want to break this down a little bit, though, because I think this is actually maybe the most valuable thing we'll talk about this whole episode.
Because everything else has been like such a gym.
Well, yeah, it's all great. But I think this is something that people can put into practice. And as we're emerging from the pandemic, you know, these opportunities are arising again or have been around for a while now. Mm. So you said, oh, you use the podcast or this or that or whatever. I want you to walk us through specifically what you did. Walk us through one of those examples, basically. So you heard someone on the podcast and then what?
For example, like I think Carlin Hudson's like a perfect example of this because like we had known of each other because we were both in Austin at the same time, but we didn't totally know each other. But then I saw that she was on y'all's podcast, so I reached out to her Facebook and I was like, hey, I saw you guys, I said you were my friends. I saw you guys, you were on my friend's podcast. I'm a big fan of your work. I'd love to talk about meeting sometime. And then we did, you know, you do that Hollywood thing where you're just talking about like, oh, I've been doing this. And right before we were gonna leave, I was like, well, what are you like working on next? Like, have you shot anything? And she was like, yeah, I just shot this short film about like an anthropomorphic butt. Mm-hmm. And I'm having trouble, like, we just shot it, I'm having trouble, like, finishing it up. She showed me the thumbnail for it, and I kid you not, I told her, like, there's no way that's not going to play at South by Southwest. If you give me the hard drive right now, I will have a cut for you in a week. And we went back to her apartment, and she gave me the hard drive. So it was a lot of stuff like that of just being really persistent and really, like, oh, you don't have an editor for this? I'll do it, you know, especially when I was trying to meet, like, directors and stuff like that.
I mean, I guess one of the very relevant things here is that you're an editor.
Yes. When I went to school, I wanted to be a writer director, and I came out of school kind of thinking that, but I had a revelation at one point, kind of around when I was listening to y'all's podcast, where I was like, I'm only ever writing so that I can have something to direct, but I'm only ever directing so I can have something to edit. So when I moved out here, I didn't want to do the whole, like, I'm a writer, director, producer, cinematographer. Mm-hmm. Anytime I saw those people, it's like, I never saw them getting jobs because no one wanted to work with someone who was like this, like, jack of all trades. They wanted you to be good at one specific thing. So I even went so far as like, I wasn't just an editor. I introduced myself as a comedy editor. That was like on all my business cards, my website and everything. And even though I didn't know anybody, even though I didn't have like as good of credits as some people, my resume kept going to the top of piles at like Cracked and College Humor and Soul Pancake. And now that I'm saying it, all these companies that don't exist anymore. It rose me through my career just saying like, I'm a comedy editor. I wanted to get more comedy jobs. And by saying like, I'm an editor, I'm doing comedy, they say not to pigeonhole yourself. But in my experience, I always tell kids like pigeonhole yourself. Mm-hmm. With it. Like if you want to work in like a certain genre, don't be afraid of saying what that is. You know,
I actually don't know if they say not to pigeonhole yourself.
Really?
Unless, I mean, I think maybe I've heard like, don't pigeonhole yourself in something that you don't like.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Right.
Like if you're the person that does these like industrials because you're like amazing at industrials, but that's not what you want to do, then you got to do something else to show people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, lately, because of Harley, I've been getting like emails every day from people that are like, hey, and it's usually people who are like your editors for like reality shows and stuff. And they're like, hey, how do I get out of reality into narrative? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was in branded, and it's just, you got to learn to say no. And you have to learn when to like course correct your career. Like there were a ton of examples where I turned down stuff for you guys or Sawhorse or like a ton of like money stuff where it was just like, if I keep doing this type of work, I'm only going to get more of this type of work. And you guys can speak to that as well. Like there comes a point where it's like, it's really hard to say no to stuff. But if you want to like make that pilot or like make that low budget feature, at a certain point, you kind of have to like, you know, start pivoting yourself towards the thing that you actually want to do. And it's really hard.
Or going back a little bit, I think the point that you were about to make is that, Andy, you were able to network partially because you could make yourself your services available to people, right?
For sure.
It's so much cleaner to be like, hey, here's a very explicit way that I can help you.
And it doesn't mean you don't need to not be a writer director. But in the context of this meeting, you're an editor, right? Because a director has very little interest in meeting other directors.
Well, and the director's whole thing is they're supposed to be like making their own work, and they're supposed to be like, I guess maybe they're meeting with other crew people or like producers trying to like get their stuff together. But for like people like me and cinematographers and stuff like that, I think it's so important for us to like, I've had other editors recommend me for stuff, and that's really helped. Maybe you guys have had things where like someone's sick and then they recommend you. That's been a big thing for me. But the bigger thing has been working with a director or producer that really likes me. And then when someone sees my name and I'm like up for a thing, they call everyone I've ever worked with. I'm sure at one point or another, I've used you guys as a ref, and someone had to be like, hey, is this person like not crazy?
Yeah.
And that's, and I was so like, absolutely bonkers. Yeah.
And Oren was like, sit down and let me tell you a tale of old.
It was Animaniacs. And I was like, he is a very wacky guy.
Yeah, exactly. Matt,
have you ever had that where someone was sick and you, have you ever been a replacement director? I don't recall any stories.
Yes, I did 2 days on a feature kind of right in the middle of the pandemic. It was hard. It was super hard. Yeah. Yeah, I think for the most part, if you're on a short-term job, you kind of just muscle through it. I also, I've been incredibly sick and still shot a full day. Like food poisoning sick. I think I told this story on the podcast a long time ago, and it's pretty gross. But I remember my AD being like, if you barf in front of me,
you were like throwing up on
set. If you barf in front of me again, I'm walking. And he was right.
I was like, I thought you were just like,
I barfed in front of
everyone. Like a horrible AD. Their job is to have your back.
It was like in front of everyone. It was disgusting.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is actually my biggest nightmare, is like showing up to like work on set or work in a studio like with like stomach pains. Like I've done that where I've like gone into like edit bays with like a huge director, like a super high paid exec. And I'm just been like, oh, my tummy hurts. And just like trying to like be cool and like sneak a heating pad onto my stomach. That's one nice thing about editing. If you're like sick and working, you can kind of make it work.
Yeah. And I feel like editing, you can, I mean, you know, I do a lot of VFX and it's like,
oh, yeah,
I could be like half dead and still be working. Are you still interested in directing and writing at all? Or are you kind
a of a little bit? I still do it from time to time. I've been really lucky that like I've had this weird leg of my career now where my favorite singer songwriter of all time, this guy, Justin Pierre, who's in the band Motion City Soundtrack. We got connected and I've directed a bunch of music videos for him. So I'm still doing stuff like every once and again, but it really is like, even when I wanted to be a director, my favorite thing was always editing, because that where it was like, you could just be in a room away from everybody. There's not like a million people yelling at you at once. You kind of just like have everything in front of you and you just have to kind of put a puzzle together. Like it kind of unlocks like the right side of my brain that's very like creative and spontaneous and wanting to try new things, and the left side that's very like calculated and organized and meticulous. And I don't know, I just get very excited about like getting really specific with like the timing of making a joke work or like shifting things around to give like entire new meaning to the scene. It just like, it just gives me like so much energy that like working with actors or writers never quite did. So I don't know, like I still do like directing from time to time, but it really is like, I feel very lucky that like I found like the thing that I really like to do. And it's something that like, it's so hard to be like a writer or a director or producer or actor. You want to be like an editor. Like it takes like a lot of hard work and gumption and everything, but there's like I would argue a more like linear path of like, oh, you could like assistant with your way up, or you could do what I did and you just work on everything. You're not competing with a bunch of other people, or you are, but it's like, it's more of, I found that editing is more of a community. We all kind of help each other.
Yeah, Matt and I basically just try to off as many directors as we can.
It's always interesting here on the podcast when you're like, oh, were you up for that thing? Oh, yeah. Oh, you didn't go to the next round? Oh.
You know, it's...
You spent how long on your lookbook?
Oh, cool. That's great. No, I feel like when we first started the show, I think that there was... it felt like there was a little bit more work and it was a little less cutthroat. And I feel like now it's... there are fewer companies, there are fewer at bats. And I think that like the milk has soured a teeny tiny bit. You know, I still believe a rising tide raises all boats, whatever.
Yeah.
But it stings a little bit more when you don't get the thing.
Oh, of course. Well, and you guys put in so much work into like, even before you get the job,
sure.
There's so much. Like in editing, there kind of is that. Like, I mean, on Harley, I had like 4 different interviews before I finally booked it. And that's not like totally abnormal. Like on most stuff, it's like I have to speak to like 2 to 3 different groups of people. And you're already kind of like cutting into your head and figuring how it's going to work. And then when you don't get it, it's such a bummer, because it's like, well, I've all this like potential and all this like built up like optimism and stuff. It's just gone. Like there's nowhere for it to go. And it still kind of stings too when it's like, oh, yeah, but person you know got it. And it's like, yeah, they deserved it, or maybe they didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So that has happened to you, where you interviewed multiple times for something you really wanted and didn't
get? Oh, loads of times. When COVID hit, it was a bit... I still was getting a lot of like work from different places, but weirdly, like animation was starting to really... And I'd always wanted to work in animation, but it was kind of like, you don't have any animation credit, so we're not interested. And I had gotten really far to... I don't know if it's out yet, but there's this show that Peter Ramsey, who is one of the Spider-Verse directors, there's a show he's directing for Netflix, and I went through like 3 different interviews from like October to December of 2020. And the day before my last one, they were like, oh, by the way, it's the director of like the biggest movie ever, and you're going to talk to him in 30 minutes. And he was really nice. And it came down to me and another person, and it went to the other person. But I've had a ton of stuff like that where, you know, you have to like interview with like the producer and the post soup and the director, of course, and then like these execs, especially on like commercials and stuff. And I don't know, it can get a little exhausting.
Do you have any interview tips, like as an editor, like things that you feel like get you the job? I mean, obviously they're not watching you edit. So what's the interview about?
I think the big thing I always try to push is that when I'm speaking to directors, I'm very much like, I work for you. And honestly, like when I tell directors all the time, like you're interviewing us, but we're interviewing you. Like anytime I talk to a director I want to work with, I call every other editor they've ever worked with. If you're like a jerk or you're tough to work with, I'm going to be the first to find out about it. But with interviews, the biggest thing I found is you want to reassure people like, look, you're spending like thousands or even millions of dollars on this thing. I got you. Like I've done this type of project before. I've worked on this kind of thing before. You're really just trying to reassure them like your money is being well spent. Bringing your footage to me, we're going to find it together. And I'm slowly getting like enough credits where my work is kind of speaking for myself of like, oh, I've done this type of commercial, or I've done this type of show. But before that, when you had anything, you really just have to kind of sell your passion and your optimism and your enthusiasm for the material. I mean, that was a big reason I think I got Harley, was because I was like a huge fan of the show. They didn't have to explain the characters or the dynamics or anything. Like I was a massive fan when I saw the show. And I think like, you don't want to be like too overly zealous, but I think making it clear that I already was familiar with material really helped me. So that's the big thing I tell people, especially if they want to get like commercial jobs or branded jobs or like even just researching the production company.
Do you think, since you bill yourself as a comedy editor, do you think it's important at all to be like funny in the interview?
Oh, I try not to be too on. I get kind of worried that like if I'm too like wacky, goofy, like you also want to sell like this is the person you're going to be sitting in a room with for like 10 to 12 hours a day. So I never want to be like too, I always am like myself, which is kind of like a big buoyant powerhouse locomotive of confidence. No, I just try to be like myself, which I think I do. I try to come off as naturally funny, but I'm not like scripting jokes or anything like that. I think that kind of works against you a little bit. I think I like to do is like when I met like with Chrissy, whether for her feature, like I made it clear, like, oh, it's kind of like this feature meets this feature. Like I wanted to make it clear, like I've read the material. I think I see what you're going for. I think I see the influence that you have, and kind of coming into that, showing that you've done the work. Mm-hmm. And again, like just being like a bit prepared with like knowing like a production company, like what they've done in the past, saying you're a fan of this and having actually watched it, you know, stuff like that is like, I think helps you get through those first rocky bumps of meetings.
You know, Andy, you bring up a point that I love. Knowing you personally, I know that you are a fan of many things. You love movies and TV, but I think it's important when you're in a scenario like this, when you're meeting with someone, you have to actually love the thing that you say you love, you know?
Yeah.
If you oversell that, that's a bummer. So there is a little bit of a superpower of being like, oh yeah, well, I love and watch a lot of things. So yes, I am conversant in Harley Quinn TV show, for instance, is really helpful.
Because I've met with people that didn't, like, where they were like, oh, I'm a big fan of Harley. And I was just like, offhand, I was like, oh, which episode? And they were like, I haven't seen it yet. And I was like, oh, buddy, that made it so much worse, you know?
It's okay to be like, ah, oh, man, you know, I've been meaning to get to it. I really loved this adjacent thing, right?
Yeah. Everyone in this town feels like they have to say like, oh yeah, I've like they pretend that they've watched this thing, and it hurts you so much more if you're like bullshitting right. your way through it. And I've caught myself doing that a couple times too, and it's always blown up in my face. But always like when I meet with a director, I try to watch like three or four things they've done and, you know, talk to other people that have worked with them, and like I try to go in as prepared as possible, but open to, you know, the possibilities of, you know, whether or not I get the job.
Going back to the point about like being funny in the room, I think being warm, right, to your point, Andy, being affable, showing enthusiasm, all that stuff is important. But I think that like trying too hard, being too sweaty is way, way worse. And most truly funny people, they can be funny in social situations. It's inappropriate to try to be super, super funny in a meeting situation unless you're a performer. If you were interviewing someone to direct a horror movie,
they better be scary.
Better be scary. No, they need to.
They pop out from behind a bookshelf going, bleh.
I usually interview those people in mirrors. Only.
Or if they just come in like really goth or whatever, or just like morose, it would just be like, yikes, this person is too much.
Bad sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get more excited when someone starts to go into like, obviously their passion for something, but if they can like tie it to, you know, not the elevator pitch is like, it's this meets this, but if they can talk about other things that I've seen, and then it just kind of like paints that picture, and it also gives you something else to talk about. That's, I think, like the most helpful thing for mm-hmm. me when I go. And I should say, I do a lot of homework when I go into interviews, to a point where it's like, when I had my first Harley Quinn one, I knew that the showrunner went to UT. I had no like animation credit. So when he was going through my resume, I made sure UT was at the top, mm-hmm. which I don't usually do. So he was like, oh, University of Texas. And I just pivoted the conversation to that.
Anyway, Andy, I want to get into Harley Quinn in a second, but my last question, because I feel like our listeners would love to hear your updated 2022 answer. You know, you said that moving to LA was a good thing, but now, I mean, even now, just talking about your interview for Harley Quinn, how you did it over Zoom. Do you still think that today it would have been helpful for you to move to LA to kind of launch the career that you have now? Or do you think you can do it from anywhere? You can do it.
That's a great question. And it's a tough one because like I do a lot of mentoring with like UT kids, and that's a big thing they ask me. And it's like, before it would have been like a resounding yes, get here right now. Now I'm not so sure, because it is like, even in those, we talk on Zoom and stuff. The big thing that I can say, and at least speaking for myself, because I always remind my wife of this when it's like we think about moving somewhere else, I could do this job from anywhere, but I get the work because I live in LA. Mm-hmm. Like I cut all of Harley season three, like five, literally I could see the water tower from my house. Like I was 5 minutes away in my bedroom, but it's like, if I had to go on the lot to like cut with the execs, or if I had to go in for a screening or something, I could, I was right there. And I think that's still primarily the case. I've seen, especially in animation, a lot of editors, I think because of COVID, have been able to live anywhere. And if you have like your one or two like big clients that you work for, amazing. Like keep the reins on them, keep your money jobs there. And yeah, you can do this job from anywhere. I still think it's important to live here because I can go to like Editors Guild meetups, or, you know, Blue Collar Post Collective meetups, or even just like going to like movies out here. Like everyone in line is like a filmmaker or works in movies. So it's just like, you can't replace getting that kind of inherent network here with anywhere else. I loved living in Austin. It's a great, great city. I would not be working on a show like Harley Quinn or for a company like Warner Brothers if I had stayed there, because I wouldn't be getting the jobs that led me to getting a show like Harley Quinn and the relationships that got me to getting Harley Quinn. So I still think it's important to move out here and to like give it the college try. Yes, a lot of stuff is going to be on Zoom, but things are opening up, you know, like you're starting to be screenings and hangouts and things like that. And I think I'm optimistic that it's only going to be more so. So I still would tell 2022, I would say the same thing that I would have said to myself in 2015. Like, if you really want to do this, again, you can do this from anywhere. If you just like, if filmmaking is like a hobby, you just love making movies for the sake of movies, more power to you. Do it from anywhere. If you want to like work at studios, or if you want to work at like a bigger level, and especially if you want to work in post, you really do have to be here. It's a bummer that that's the way it is, but it's the way that it is. So if you're really serious about having a career as an editor and working on those bigger projects, I think you do have to live in it.
I think that that point is really apt. And I think that like a few years from now, I'll be curious to see where the people who kind of moved to the periphery are. Like, do they come back? Right. Do they try something different? Are they thriving? I hope they're thriving. But because I often think like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to like move to like Camarillo, like move up into Ventura County, like, you know, hang out. Maybe schools are a little bit better. The weather's nice. And just drive down for if I have a shoot in L.A. It's not a big deal. I could couch surf or whatever. But your point of like the localization of community and is something that I've taken for granted because of the way that I've been living for the last few years, which is pretty isolated and hanging out with a baby.
But even going like, you guys had these amazing Christmas parties now in feature form, but like I would go to those and it's like you're constantly surrounded by like filmmakers and people trying to make things, and you're all like, oh, let's do stuff together, oh, let me introduce you to this person. It's just like you have that, there's a little communities for that anywhere in the US or anywhere in the world, but it's like it's just different.
Yeah.
It's like every movie you go to, every like meetup you go to, it's like there's always
every
like
someone... Christmas party you throw. Yeah. Yeah,
it really is. Like even like, you know,
Starbucks reserve.
But I will say, I don't give that advice lightly, because I imagine like, you know, because when I moved here, I was like, you know, whatever, like 23. And like, I was making like barely like five figures a year, barely, you know? So it's like when I moved here, I didn't really have anything to lose. It was kind of like, well, I'll try LA. And like, worst case scenario, I'll go back. And now I'm like, I'm 31. It's like, I just bought a house.
Bought a house that you can see the Warner Brothers water tower from?
Now I'm a little farther from the Warner. Okay. I'm in Reseda now, so I'm a little farther away. But it's still like, it's a stupid amount of money that we paid. I have land in where they shot Karate Kid in Boogie Nights. It's harder for me to just like drop everything and like do a short for fun, or to try to, it gets harder. And I just try to like let people know, like, I don't say it lightly of like trying to like change your career at the drop of your hat. It's hard, and it gets harder the more responsibilities and stuff that you get. But I don't know. It's like, if you want to be a narrative and stuff, it's like, there's sometimes certain things that you just have to do in order to course correct your career.
Let's jump into Harley Quinn. Tell us about editing animation. Yeah. Is it super easy because there's no coverage?
Yeah. I'm truly curious about what editing animation entails.
I'll say that I cut Harley Quinn season 3, now available on HBO Max, and I'm currently cutting an animated Batman movie. And both of them have been totally different. So the way we cut Harley, we get all of our main cast immediately. Kaley Cuoco, Jim Rash, like day one, like we're getting them all.
When you say get them, you mean you record all of their lines?
We get them in the booth and record like their lines for like an episode or whatever.
Before anything is animated.
Before anything is animated, before anything is drawn, we get like, we put together like a radio play basically. It's like, if you close your eyes and watch the episode, we put together that. Maybe it doesn't have a ton of music, or maybe the sound effects isn't super specific because we want to give the board artist room to like make their choices, but it's all the timing of the jokes and stuff like that.
Which is a new style of animation. It used to be board driven. Having a director for animation was felt a little strange to me because the board artists were really the people coming up with
gags. Well, they do oversee the board artists. A lot of times the directors are board artists themselves.
Sure. But I'm saying like in the 90s, it was like the jobs were quite different. And I think probably the reason why board artists are now directors is because they were in many ways the authorial voice of the show.
For sure.
Yeah, back in the day. I mean,
it's important to note that Harley Quinn was created by people who like come from live action, like Justin and Pat Schumacher and stuff. So it's like largely animation is still like what you said, Matt, like the board artists do it, and then you get the voices later. That's what it is on Batman. But for Harley, it's like the timing of the jokes was so specific and so important that we actually put a ton of time. You usually don't do this on animated shows, but like once we did the radio play, we would send it to the board artist and they would kind of like do their version of it. Director gets a pass, et cetera. It all comes back to me. I would tighten up boards and then I would do a full music and sound effects pass. And apparently that's really rare. I've talked to other animatic editors and they're like, that's crazy. What a waste of time. It's all going to be replaced. But as you guys know, it's so important to the timing of a joke or even like a fight scene to like make sure it has like the energy that it needs, the flow that it needs, the emotional beats that it needs. So we really like.
Who told you not to do? I'm like so frustrated by editors that don't realize how important sound effects and music are. It's like
always delicate. Like, even like animatics are like by and large, like they're designed to be super rough, but you have to like really, I am a firm believer of like, I'm with you. I'm a firm believer. Like I hate seeing like Times New Roman font and like no music and like,
I mean,
no,
I think the sound
pass
is way more important than the picture cut. Like,
absolutely.
And I
you
work with these
the
editors.
Dialogue.
Yeah. Hear the dialogue. And also like, you know, I've been working on all this office stuff and we always talk about like, if there's an awkward pause, let's hear like a phone ringing in the background or something
yes
to accentuate the awkwardness. And like, they're like, well, there's a sound designer. I'm like, you are like,
yeah, do the
by
first
the way,
pass.
The sound designer has like one day. They're just going to sweeten whatever you do. So
they're going to sweeten whatever you
do.
They're like enhance it or whatever. No, but it is like, I even on like branded stuff and everything I've done, I've always am really serious about my sound effects passes and my music passes. I know it's all going to get replaced or whatever, but I always want to make sure.
Does every single sound effect you put in get replaced
on
Harley Quinn?
Like watching, I watched like the first three. No, I've watched the whole season animated and it's like a lot of it is like the same sound effect. Sometimes they'll replace things and make it better, but it's still like the timing of like something.
Like you set the timing.
Exactly.
Which also means you set the timing of the dialogue, which means you set the timing of what the storyboard artists write, right? And if there's a car screeching by or something.
Yeah, it only helps, like, especially once you go to animation. I think like those like sound cues really help make sure it's very specific. Like this is when a character claps or this is when like a punch locks, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. But basically, as I was saying, like the process, it really is like you're making this radio play and I forget which one of y'all said it. But yeah, it's like you have no coverage, which is really exciting when it's like, oh, my gosh, like I don't have to worry about like getting these takes together. It's like you can really Frankenstein to a point where I had to like draw myself back. I was like, I can make the perfect comedic take with 5 takes. And it's like, no, just like you got to let it breathe a little bit, stretch it back. But you can really, you get very spoiled going from animation to live action where it's like, oh, my gosh, like you can really create the timing from scratch. You do have limitations of like, OK, well, you know, the directors and producers really do run things in terms of, I would say they have more of a control over like the visual edit of a show. But I have control over the audio edit. Like it really is when you watch like my episodes of Harley Quinn, that's 99% me, you know, like maybe they'll change things here and there because sometimes animation comes back slow and you have to like frame finesse things and drop frames kind of like you would in action stuff anyways. But like overall, it's like the timing of that is like from what we found together.
I wonder if of the freedom that you have actually is the result of people thinking of it as rough.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like,
I think that's a fair point of it. Yeah.
Like if you nail it, then great. They just go ahead and use what you did. But like if it was roughed in a little bit more, they would have fixed it. But no one's watching because it's just the rough version. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think it helps, again, like most of our showrunners on Harley came from live action, both the showrunners and the, you know, the writers that took over for this season. It's like they all came from live action. And this was my first animated show, too. So we were kind of all in this together. But to Oren's point, it's like I'm always big on selling a cut. So I'll put in titles. They like to make fun of me. Like in animation, you do a lot of like temp voices before you get read. So I would like do the characters' voices. Mm-hmm. Nobody told me not to. I would do like my Clayface and my King Shark and my Joker. And I would like, you know, I'm not an actor, but it's like whatever you can do to like really sell a cut, make sure jokes are landing and stuff. It brings like a certain energy to your cut that you wouldn't get if you were just kind of, to Oren's point, just like, here's where the dialogue is going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, like someone will put a gunshot in here eventually. That's lunch. It's like I get very specific about like even my music use. I would spend hours of just like finding Jeff's going to come in later and just like crush it. But I would go like, okay, like I'll use this like My Hero Academia song for like this fight scene, or I'll use this Run the Jewels thing for this setup. It's like I would really try to like make sure that if you watch the animatic, the energy of the cut is there. Like I've looked at other animatics for other shows and they don't take that as seriously, which I'm always a little surprised by. Some do, but a lot of ones I've seen aren't as big on it. But Batman, we're doing the same. It's just kind of in the reverse where like the board artists give us stuff. We put in temp voices, mm-hmm. and eventually we'll get our superstar cast, like pretty much at the last minute.
They're giving you stills, the board artists, or like animated?
Yeah, it's basically like hundreds and hundreds of JPEGs in a timeline. They use the program, or at least we do at Warner Brothers, called Storyboard Pro, and they'll send, you guys probably know what like an XML is. It's basically like something that you can export to or from that has like all of the data, like this shot, this image is like this many frames long. This one is this many frames. And then we basically send XMLs back and forth to each other. So I'm getting not just like all of the storyboards in a row, but it's like keeping my timing or like a bit of their timing or stuff like that. And it can be a little exhausting when it's just like, oh my gosh, like no joke. I just for today on Batman, I got have a scene that has 1500 individual images and they're all like a second long. And it's up to me to like go through each one. And it's like, this one's going to be this many frames. And it's like,
and you have to learn like shots.
They're all different like poses. So it's like if like Harley's like reaching for like a bat or something, it's like her still pose and then her hand's coming out and then it's coming out a little more. And then it's like she grabs the bat.
Oh,
and
interesting.
Then it's like if you watch an animatic, it's like all of these like kind of hero poses and then they'll fill everything else in an animation. But you're like you have to learn like, oh, a person can't walk that fast. So mm-hmm. you have to like
kind
of learn a lot of that stuff as well, which took me a little getting used to for sure.
For instance, like when someone is like walking across a room or something like that.
Yeah.
Are you masking things? Are you like, you know, you're like having them slide across the frame as they're walking? Like there's a little bit of like lo-fi animation happening as well.
We do a little bit of that. I would say we mostly are masking stuff to like kind of hide things, or like if the director's like, oh, I want like this kid to be smiling in this shot, can we just steal this smile, put it over it, and then we'll fix it in the boards later. We do a lot of little stuff like that. On Harley, we definitely did a lot of like motion stuff. And also, you know, camera moves is a big thing as well. Like I would pitch certain things where I'm like, I really think it's going to be funnier if we do like a snap zoom out of this, or if we're like kind of like slowly moving along with them. So you get a bit of say as well in that, because some artists they'll just kind of give you the stills and kind of expect you to put in like some sort of camera frame move. Others will be like, oh, it's going to be this really cool one, or where it goes like from here and then we're back to here and then we're like going over here, and you still get to like kind of finesse it. And again, it's like with the dialogue, it's like you don't have that perfect camera shot on set. Well, you can really get like perfect with it mm-hmm. on here, making sure the dialogue time is like crisp and like you're getting the beats right on it. It's really infinite, which makes it harder, but it's also, again, like I love editing because I love puzzles and putting stuff together. It just makes it so much more fun as well. And like, honestly, like Harley is like the closest. It's some of the most creative freedom I've ever had in my career. It's the closest I've ever got to like what was in my head in when I read the script mm-hmm. to getting it on the page, just from like you getting all of the assets the way that we do.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me. A thing I think about a lot with editors and, you know, kind of a younger generation and an older school generation. And the difference is that oftentimes I prefer a younger generation because they are more nimble with the tool set, right? Like they're temping in, they're split screening things and like combining takes and you know, dropping in like pretty advanced VFX, frankly. Like, they're not final versions necessarily, but yeah, like, you know, like they're, you're getting in there, rolling up your sleeves. Whereas with an older school editor, or just one that kind of comes from like a maybe a purist perspective, I have to be the one who's like, okay, well, let's, what if we, can we combine these takes? Can, you know, reverse that a little bit, or this or that, you know, like kind of the tricks that you have up your sleeve. And I would certainly put you in that new school. I guess what I'm getting at, Andy, is that I wonder if that skill set has informed the way that you're approaching these animatics, basically.
Oh, most definitely. And that's, I've never really thought about that way, but that is a good way to put it. Like, I remember I was around like 14 or 15, I think, when YouTube really became a thing. So I'm kind of from this first generation of editors where we were all making like our own little like music videos, mm-hmm, or like re-edits or making stuff with our friends. And it's like, well, we grew up with, you know, iMovie and like even like Final Cut and stuff like that, where it's like, oh, I can like replace this thing, or I can make this effect on my own, or I can do this title. And I think when you come up through doing film school like that and finally get professional jobs like that, you kind of do keep that skill set. Whereas I'm not sure someone who, like my co-editor on Harley, Dave Porter, who's like an incredibly talented editor, he's been an animation editor like as long as I've been alive. And I think he does have a lot of those skills, but it is interesting of like, I don't like know if he would have come into it in the same way that I did, which was kind of like figuring it out like went long before anyone would have paid me to do this. So it's interesting at Warner Brothers, it's like half the people are around my age as editors and the other half are in their like 50s and 60s, and both groups are super talented. I feel like I'm running for office or something, but like, but I think there is something I've noticed in my own group. Like, we all started like making YouTube shit at the same time. We all kind of grew up on like The Lonely Island and Derek Comedy at the same time. And when you do that, you have this innate thing of like learning After Effects, mm-hmm, and learning how to like do these little tricks and stuff that you don't get from learning the more traditional approach, right, to, yeah, like editing.
Yeah, like
the more purist, as you
would say. The idea of like opening up After Effects as part of your edit,
it's not as much of a reason to, because it's like, again, and again, like it goes to me, like I really want to always sell a cut. So it's like, if I can like spend 5 minutes like dynamic linking something to just make like a cooler title, I'll totally do it. It's not going to be the final thing, but if I do that kind of stuff, it's going to get away from getting like the very nitpicky notes that come with like, why can't I hear this person? Why does it look so gray? That we're all familiar.
Why
with
does it look so gray?
Oh my gosh. I won't say who. I did a project with someone recently and there's like a blue sky in it. And the client was like, this guy's, can we like swap this out with a shot of a blue sky? And I was like, you're doing color tomorrow, yeah, my guy. Yeah. Like you're close.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
I worked on something last year where the editor was like total veteran, like had done all these feature films you've seen in the movie theater.
Of course.
And he didn't temp anything.
Wow.
And I was like, he was just like old school. I was like, yeah, I usually have assistants that do all this stuff for me, but he didn't have an assistant on this project. And it is interesting to see the difference between like new school, the YouTube iMovie After Effects editors, and old school.
You know, it's weird on Harley, I don't have an assistant editor, or on Batman, which has been a little weird.
That's very interesting. Tell us more.
Well, this is my first like animated show, right? And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm working with like a giant studio and a big like characters that everyone has heard of. But it's like, I'm doing like all the assistant edit work myself as well, which I don't know if that's an animation thing or a Warner Brothers thing. So I won't tell too many tales out of school, but it has been a little weird of like, I'm finally at this level of my career and I'm still doing a lot of that like assistant stuff. Like I'm still pulling all my own selects and I'm still, you know, searching for my own music and stuff like that, which is a little weird, but it kind of keeps me honest. Like weirdly, I feel like I'm kind of back in high school when I was making like sketches with my friends. Like this is the closest I've felt to that in my career, my professional career.
What's the story behind Batman? Did you get that through Harley Quinn, I'm assuming?
I kind of got it through See You Next Christmas, if you can believe it.
Yeah, buddy.
What? I will not believe it.
So, okay, here's what happened. On Harley, they got to a point where they didn't need me anymore, essentially. The original editor from the first two seasons wanted to come back, and it was like, okay, we have three editors and we need two. Are we going to go with the guy who's edited the first two seasons, the guy who's been doing this since the 90s, or this new kid that just cut this? And I was obviously the one, which is fine. But Warner Brothers like really wanted to keep me in, so they put me up for this movie called Merry Little Batman, which was being directed by Mike Roth, who's, you know, right-hand man on Regular Show, was an OG board artist on SpongeBob, like a super talented, funny guy. And so I think my name got pushed up partly because I'd done a bunch of Christmas stuff. Like I had on my resume, I had done this Christmas feature film for Matt and his partner, Chrissy, who directed it. And I'd also cut this Carly Rae Jepsen Christmas music video.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
My resume like shot to the top because it was like, oh, Christmas. Hella and Christmas. Animation.
Yeah,
perfect.
There you go.
You've worked with Batman. You've worked with Christmas. It's all there, you know? I initially didn't want to... I was a really tough sell. I kind of had to like stick to my guns because they were like, we want to edit in Storyboard Pro. And I was like, no, I'm going to edit in Premiere. And they were like, okay. But we... and it was... I don't know. There was a lot of things where I really pushed on and I'm surprised they still went with me. But I was at my wedding dancing with my niece and I was like, I really want to make something that you can watch because she cannot watch Harley, at least for another like 15 years. So it's been weird doing like a kids project, but it's been really fulfilling as well. I wish I could say more about it, but it's I'm really excited about it. It's very, very goofy and sincere. And I'm hoping it will become a Christmas classic, much like See You Next Christmas.
And this is not in the world of Lego Batman. It's not Will Arnett Batman.
It's not Will Arnett. I can confirm that. It is someone very famous who's going to be Batman.
Oh,
we're recording this after the first three episodes of Harley came out. And it's been really incredible just seeing like, oh, right. Like, you work on this expecting no like. It just lives in a vacuum. And now like millions of people are like making all this like beautiful fan art and saying how much they love the show. And it's very overwhelming with this level of like characters that everyone's familiar with, you know.
Is it Union?
Oh, yeah. This was my first Union show, which was nice. It's animated Union, so it's not a ton of money. I'm going to be on Batman for at least a year and I'm starting to get courted by agents and stuff. So I'm kind of hoping the next phase of my career can start getting back into live action stuff again, which I'm starting to get a couple offers on and stuff. But I'm still not sure if like. I'm bringing Chuck E. Cheese tokens to a bank by having animated credits. Again, it goes to that pigeonholing thing of like, have I pigeonholed myself too far where it's like, oh, well, now we only see you as an animation editor.
I wouldn't think so. Just because, yeah. I mean, HBO Max is like obviously like a prestige network. Mm-hmm. It's like a DC popular, you know, like superhero franchise. And I feel like the fact that it's animated or not. And again, like you work for showrunners that come from traditional live action. I don't know. I think it's not Chuck E. Cheese. Yeah.
If you did another animated thing, you might be taking a serious step in that direction. Do you know what I mean?
I think so, yeah. Too. Yeah. And that's why I was a little apprehensive on if I was going to take Batman, because part of me was like, okay, well, maybe I can like start getting some stuff based on Harley before it comes out. But now that it's being released, I'm hoping, because it is like, at the end of the day, Harley is like an adult show. You know, it's an Arrested Development or what have you. It's like a sitcom. So it's like, I'm hoping that at least having like the tone and stuff like that makes up for the fact that like it is animated and that is a different style of editing. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like, I have examples of live action stuff I've done. I don't know. That's something I'm sure you guys go through that as a director too, but I'm always wondering about that.
Well, Andy, we could talk to you about this stuff forever. Thank you so much for finally coming on the show. We asked you and asked you and asked you and finally you said yes.
I know Matt's joking, but it is really fun to have you on the show. Like, congrats on your success. It's like awesome. And, you know, I know I opened this whole thing up by taking credit for all your success, but like, no, you obviously are super talented and knowledgeable. And like anyone that even just follows you on Twitter could tell that, like, you know, you're meant for this industry and that you like, obviously you're going to thrive in it. So
thanks,
congrats.
Well, I remember like when I first booked Harley, I got off the phone and for like the first minute, I was like, maybe this will be enough to get me on Just Shoot It. Maybe this will be the one. That like this is the credit that'll convince them to bring me on.
But you've never asked to be on before either. Like,
I don't know. I always felt it would be weird to ask. But then once like I booked Harley and that came out, I was finally like, OK, like I know you guys don't talk to a ton of editors, but I feel like this is a big enough credit to be cool.
Yeah.
I mean, freaking Carlin Hudson's been on like 30 times. When's my meal?
Yeah. Fair enough, Eddie.
We're not going to have her on again. Don't worry. For your request.
Oh, she's a gem. Have her on every time. I was kind of waiting for the right one. I've weirdly had people that recognize my name from, because y'all have talked about me on different episodes. So I've like meet other editors and they're like, oh, from Just Shoot It. And I was like, no, I've never been on. But it is like, you guys have made such a great podcast that I always recommend to like film students and even people who are like deep into their careers, because you guys are so good at like, you know, there's so many like books and stuff out there about like filmmaking and like the real technical craft of it. But we in film school, they never talk about the business side of things and getting an agent and like, course correcting and navigating to like these things and like setting up pitches and, you know, like the actual work that goes into being a working director. And I really love that you guys have demystified the process as much as you have over the last like 6-7 years. So kudos to you guys. And again, thanks to you for having me be a part of it. This has been a dream come true.
Of course, buddy. Before we hop into unpaid endorsements, Andy, where can listeners learn more about you? How can they keep track of the world of Andy Young?
Yeah, if you want more of this, you can find me on all of the D-Limit things at Andy Young. My website is Andy Young Film. Harley Quinn season 3 is playing on HBO Max every Thursday right now. Go check it out. I'm super duper proud of it. I edited episodes 1, 3, 4, 7, and 9. And then I was the radio play editor on 2. So all of the best ones. No, the whole season is freaking amazing. And I truly am like, I'm so proud of the whole show. Hit me up and let me know what you think of it. I talk a lot about like editing and sharing my timelines. And again, I try to really break down the process and make it seem like it's something that you can do if you also started in your parents' Dell computer editing anime music videos on Windows Movie Maker. So come along for the ride. I'm around.
Well, awesome. Do you have a few minutes to hang out with us and do an unpaid endorsement?
Most definitely.
Unpaid endorsements.
I'm going to kick it off, but this is apropos to both Oren and Andy in a real way. My endorsement is the remix tool on the newest version of Premiere. The remix tool, it's kind of buried actually, but it's a tool in Premiere basically. Take a look for the remix tool. And what it is it's a music editing AI adjuster. So you've ever been in the situation where you're like, oh, I need this sting to ring out a little bit longer, or like, oh, this song is playing too fast or too slow. The AI analyzes the track and then matches your edit relative to what you're stretching it or shortening it to. It is incredible.
I always tell like composers, I'm like, make a version of your song that has that's like loopable. A ring out.
Yeah.
Have one that's a hard stop and have one that's like a ring out. And have it loopable and swell. It like drives me crazy trying to find, oh my God, that's going to... So it like adds like a little bit of reverb and like stuff like that.
It's more like... that... And look, I haven't really put it through its paces just yet. And also 2 of the 3 times that I've used it, it has crashed. Premiere, so caveats
like that morph cut thing they had for a while where it's like it'll match it exactly, but it's going to take years for it to actually
it's
work
in that school. However, it works better than morph cut, and I'll use morph cut every once in a while. I get it.
Oh, I still sneak it in all the time, absolutely.
But I think it's more that it understands the beat of the song and understands like where to loop things. So like I think it's more likely to add an additional measure or two in the chorus than it is to stretch the end necessarily.
Oh, interesting. So you can like drag it out to a certain point and it can keep like if you find like an instrumental
it'll
section,
keep it going.
Like, it'll understand it. Wow,
I would bet
that's really going to change my
I
life.
Bet there's some strategy to like splicing the track at a certain point and then stretching it out. Like if you want the intro to be untouched, basically, or I'm sure there's some finagling to it. I'll say in the case of like drones and stings and suckbacks, all of that stuff that's like elemental rather than pure music. It's been awesome for.
Oh, nice. Because I use that all the time on like even Batman right now. I'll have to like speed up or slow down like a song. Uh-huh. Like, oh, I want it to last this long, but then it sounds clippy.
Yep.
And like,
yep.
I'll have to like ring this out and like reverb and stuff. I'm really excited to check this out now. That sounds dope.
So that is my endorsement. Mr. Andy Young, what you got, sir?
I'm sure this has been pitched at some point because I thought about like, should I do like a fun one or like a helpful one? And I'm going to do a fun one that's been helpful to me. Not in my career, but I really like it. There's this website called letterboxd.com that I'm a big fan of. I'm sure your listeners are already on it. If you're not, it's basically like a movie diary website, kind of Instagram-ish. And it's really, I love it because it's a great way to, as my brain turns into like hamburger meat, it's just a great way to like remember movies I've seen, where I've seen them, why I liked or didn't like something that I watched. But what I really like about it, which really like changed my life during the pandemic, especially when we were all just like sitting around watching movies, their watch list function. I used to have a watch list on IMDb and it was like fine or whatever, but like the watch list on Letterboxd is great because you can sort it by like genre and runtime and all these different things. But you can also, if you're a pro member, you can plug in the streaming services that you have. So if you're like, okay, I want to watch something on Netflix that's like sci-fi and I want it to be like something from like the 80s, it's like you could plug all this in and it'll find it. So I'm really big fan of if you, like, to me, I'm sure I'm not alone. My wife and I spend a lot of time sitting on the couch trying to figure out what to watch. And this is a really good website to be able to kind of like whittle something down, just be able to like make lists and stuff that you want to do. So letterboxd.com, highly, highly recommend. And I'm Andy Young Film on that if you want to follow along on things that I like and don't like.
I love Letterboxd. You are a power user. I can vouch for your avid usage of it.
That's awesome. Yeah, Matt, I think endorsed Letterboxd probably circa like 2018 or something.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I never really paid attention to it until just now. Now
you should get on it, even if you're not like, I'm super active on it, but even if you're not, it's a great way to like I like when we were in the quarantine, it's like, okay, I've always wanted to watch all the Oscar winners, or I've always wanted to watch the AFI 100. It makes it so easy to like go through and like you can hide all the stuff that you've seen. You can just show stuff that's in your streaming services. They're just a great company, and I love them. Super cool place for filmmakers and for movie dorks alike. Like anytime I start a project, I always make like a list of like movies. Like when I did Chrissy's movie, I made like a list of all of her favorite films and stuff. And I just like, okay, these are the ones on streaming. Now I can just go through and rewatch them and stuff, you know?
Well, it's that great. I would never do. But, and that's why, and kind of when Matt talked about it, I'm just obviously giving him a hard time, but like it did kind of feel like a place for, you know, film lovers to like talk and rate movies and stuff. But like this other thing that you're talking about, which is like, hey, I want to see a comedy that came out in the last 5 years that is on one of these streaming services.
Yeah.
That to me is huge, because that is, 90% of our TV watching is that. Cool. Well, that's really good. I have a weak endorsement. I just worked with a treatment designer and she pulled a bunch of images and she used this website called PicDrop, PICDROP.com, to share the pictures with me. It's actually like a European site. And it was really awesome because it lays out the photos really nice. First of all, the way it arranges the images is like super cool. You just have a link, you send it to someone and you scroll through hundreds of images, and any image you like, you can click on it, you can download it, you can look at it big, or you can select it as an image that you like.
The designers sourced all these images though. Like they had them ready to rock and then uploaded them to PicDrop and then sent you the link. Is that right?
So one thing is, she found all the images and put them here and put them on the link. And then, you know, I can, if you click on to edit mode, you can put like green flags or red flags, or you can sort them. You can say, oh, I like these for this section and this for this section. So if you're kind of collaborating with someone else on a bunch of images, but also once you make a PicDrop gallery, it saves all those photos. So let's say like, you know, this sample I'm showing you guys was for like a kind of sci-fi abstract, like kind of Gen Z project. If she's doing another Gen Z project, she can go and pick all her favorite images from here and just put it in the new gallery. So it's kind of like a repository for your own images, but you can build galleries out of them and add to them to share with other people. So if you're working on a lookbook or a deck, or you want to just show someone, it could even be family photos and you're trying to figure out which one's the print or whatever, wedding photos, anything.
Yeah.
It's just a really cool resource. And
I love it. It's like a sleek, like Squarespace site for a DP. Mm-hmm. And that's like the highest like praise I can like say for it. Like it looks so clean. I'm a big sucker for like color markers and stuff like that. I use that all the time, especially in animation. I love that. Ooh. You can like highlight things of like, oh, red's maybe not this, orange maybe for this thing. Like that's so dope. Like
maybe I should do one more unpaid endorsement, which is Andy's file color system.
Oh yeah, I forgot I gave you those. I worked with an assistant editor once who, like, I'm very specific about my bin structure, and they sent me like the files that I had requested, but they had like all the folders in Mac had these like icons and different colors and stuff. And I was like, how did you do this? And she sent me like this giant file of like all these little icon sized things, and you can like basically customize all of them. They take up no space at all, and they can be like different colors and stuff. And again, like the colors match like what my bins are in Premiere, so it just adds that extra level.
So you're saying, like, rather than a little folder icon, it's like, okay, well, I know all of my footage is a little film.
It could
strip.
Be a red folder with like a film reel on it, or you could even be like a picture of a music note, and it's like a PNG, so it's like clear behind it. So I think you have to be a very visual person to do what we do. So it really does help to be able to be like, okay, all my footage is in red, my music is in yellow, my sound effects is in green. Like it helps just a little bit more to be able to like quickly color code.
Yeah, in Finder and Mac OS. Finder.
I match it in Premiere, but yeah, Finder is like the big
one. In Premiere, though, I have a follow-up question now. In Premiere, is your footage color coded as well? So you're dropping things in, you know, oh, voiceover is blue, interview footage is green or whatever.
I actually do like so Harley is a great example of like, if you look at any of my timelines that I'm going to be posting, it's like Harley's voice is pink and Poison Ivy's is green mm-hmm. and Clayface's is orange. And if you're not familiar with the show, those are more or less like the colors that the characters have. So it's like, it's been invaluable in animation when you don't have visual things to tie to be like, okay, I can see that this mm-hmm. is like a Poison Ivy scene. Here's like a Commissioner Gordon scene. It helps like with like that visual scope. But even in live action, like I've started doing it a lot in like music videos, especially like on my Carly Rae Jepsen one, I did that for all the different setups. I've done that for, obviously it's nice to know like, okay, this is my multicam stuff. This is my single stuff. This is my MOS stuff, like simple things like that. But even then it's like my voiceover is its own color. Music's its own color. Mm-hmm. Sound effects is its mm-hmm. own color. I could do like a whole another hour on just like how I love organizing in Premiere. It's so dorky, but it makes you so much better and faster. I can't recommend it enough. That's my unpaid endorsement, being good at your job.
Awesome. Well, Andy, this was great.
If you guys have any questions or thoughts or want to send us an email about what Andy said, if you disagree with him, we'd especially like to hear you. JustShootItPod@gmail.com. You can find us across all social media at JustShootIt. We have a website, JustShootItPod.com. And you can find me. I'm on Twitter at SmiteyPyleg. I'm on Instagram at OKaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Benlow. This episode is edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. And you're listening to music by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.